Alright everyone, hello again and welcome back to this week's episode. I'm sorry it took 2 weeks to get this episode out. I'll hopefully be able to put out episodes regularly when I'm done with college for the year. But right now I'm going to have to do a lot of finals and I probably won't be able to put out another episode until the end of this quarter. But then the good news will be that I'll have the entire summer to put out more episodes. So hopefully I'll be able to put them regularly out week by week because I won't be doing anything with my time besides sitting around working and reading. So I decided to use this week's episode as a time to answer some more questions that I received over the email. This episode is just going to be me entirely answering questions. I think they're good questions, and I think we'll get a lot out of them. But I'm going to try, for the next episode, to not base it solely on these questions. I'm going to try and do an actual episode along with answering some of the questions I've received. Because I'm not going to answer all the questions I got in this specific episode, because I got more than I can use to fill the entire time. So, I'm going to start out with one emailer gave me a long list of questions. His name was Eric, and he gave me about four questions, which I felt would be good to present on the show and kind of lead us into some different topics that I haven't really touched on in any of the previous episodes. So, he first asks about punctuated equilibrium versus the idea of gradualism in Darwinian theory. He writes, "It seems logical to me that the reason someone would posit punctuated equilibrium is because of a lack of evidence supporting gradual change. So by its very existence, it, punctuated equilibrium, makes a claim that weakens the case for gradualism, and this is merely two theories that came from natural scientists." Now I think this is a good question because there's a lot of misunderstanding revolving around the idea of punctuated equilibrium. What exactly is punctuated equilibrium and what is its effect on gradualism? What does it have to say about gradualism and where do the two conflict and maybe where do the two agree? Now a little bit of history on punctuated equilibrium and what exactly it is. It was proposed in 1977 by scientists Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge, and it was different means of approaching the question of how evolution actually occurs. For a long time, for most of the history of evolution, there had been this idea of phyletic gradualism, which is this idea of slow but steady. The evolution of evolution would be slow, but it would be a steady process. It wouldn't occur in any leaps or bounds in certain areas. It would be fairly steady. And they based this idea off of the principle of uniformitarianism, which was that things were, again, slow and gradual processes. This is geologically speaking, but they carried it over to evolution, and that's how the notion of phyletic gradualism came about. Now, what Gould and Eldridge thought when they developed punctuated equilibria is not that they're replacing this notion of gradualism, but rather refining it. I mean, of course, the notion of a slow but steady change is not really present in the academic literature, and this is argued for by various scientists. Richard Dawkins, namely, is one of them. Darwin himself made it clear that he did not think that change in species was a uniform process. He did not think it was entirely uniform, and he did accept that certain parts of a population won't evolve with others, and that it will be a kind of jump and kind of staticky process for a while, and then it will jump again. So I think there's kind of this straw man notion of evolution being this purely steady state, gradualistic kind of change idea. It isn't that, it never was. And what mainly differentiates punctuated equilibrium from this phyletic gradualism, which was the supposed earlier idea, was that it's just the means of evolution. The emailer is correct that punctuated equilibrium was posited because there was a lack of evidence supporting the uniformness of phyletic gradualism. Gould and Eldridge noticed that there were large periods of stasis in the fossil record and felt that the gradualism alone kind of ignored this fact that there was stasis in the fossil record. And suddenly we'd see, geologically speaking, that there was kind of a jump there. Gould and Eldridge wanted to use this stasis in the fossil record as evidence and not simply just pass it off and say, well, we're going to kind of ignore it, but our view of gradualism is still correct, even though it doesn't fit the evidence, totally. Their view is that evolution occurred not in a neat way that the phyletic gradualism proposes, as I said before, but it includes these periods of stasis, and then has some relatively rapid periods of speciation. Now, when I say rapid, I need to define the term a little bit better, because rapid is pretty vague. Now, when I use the term rapid, what I mean is that the daughter species of the main species appears in a relatively rapid time in comparison with the entire lifespan of the species itself. In other words, say we're looking at a certain species and it's existed for 12 million years, which is a very short amount of time, geologically speaking. Well, we could say its daughter species appeared within a few hundred thousand years. That would be rapid in comparison to the entire existence of the species. So that's what I mean when I say rapid. So if we have a creature existing for, say, 100 million years, then rapid, you know, it doesn't give any credence to the notion of creationism per se. When people hear rapid, they might misconstrue it as, wow, 6 days perhaps. Well, no, it doesn't happen within a few generations. It happens over millions and millions of years. Rapid is really only geologically speaking. In terms of real time, it's going to take a long, long time, just like any process of evolution actually does. So the word rapid doesn't mean what some people might think it means. Another good question is, how does speciation occur in punctuated equilibria? Maybe this differentiates it from phyletic gradualism. Well, not really. In punctuated equilibrium, we see that using some already well-accepted and observed mechanisms, speciation occurs through these means. I read a Talk Origins article on punctuated equilibria to find out a little bit more about it, and I read it lists two major causes of speciation in punctuated equilibria as allopatric and parapatric speciation. So, what are these? Well, aside from going into the details, which I might do in a later episode, what happens with both of these mechanisms is that they're based on this idea of isolation of a species. If two populations of the same species are geographically isolated for a long period of time, they will probably become two different species and be unable to reproduce with one another. And we're going off of Ernst Mayr's definition of what a species is, and they're reproductively isolated. They cannot reproduce with any other form of creature. They have to reproduce within their own species, and of course, that's what makes them a species. They can only reproduce within their own group. So the main difference between punctuated equilibria and gradualism, as I said before, is the rate at which evolution occurs. Instead of being the slow, steady, gradualistic process, in punctuated equilibria what we have is periods of stasis followed by periods of relatively rapid speciation to occur. Now both allow, again, considerable time for speciation to occur. It's only geologically speaking that people get this misconception that speciation takes place in a very quick time. Thus, punctuated equilibria is, instead of being exclusive, like mutually exclusive with gradualism, what we see is that it's actually an addition to gradualism, with that addition being the rate of evolution and the better fitting of the evidence. So summarily, this purely gradual view of evolution has been replaced by a more fulfilling idea, that the rate is not entirely uniform, and this fits the evidence a lot better than pure gradualism. If you're more familiar with cosmology, it might help to see this kind of as inflationary cosmology being an addition and not a replacement of standard Big Bang cosmology. Unfortunately, punctuated equilibria is subject to vast misconception because of some of the wording involved with it. The word rapid, for instance, I felt I had to define because it could be abused and taken advantage of by creationists, for example. For instance, in Gould and Eldridge's 1977 paper, which I happen to take a look at, in their abstract, they speak of evolution occurring in geologically instant spans of time. Now, the wording is somewhat vague, and again, easily subject to abuse by people who want to abuse the wording by evolutionists, quote-unquote, to kind of get their own way. And one must realize, and this is, again, a huge point, is that these ideas aren't mutually exclusive. They kind of build off of one another. One is a refinement of the previous idea, and it makes better use of the evidence, as I said before. So our concept of evolution has changed over time, that is true, but what is still agreed upon by scientists, biologists are the ones who deal with it, of course, but it's that evolution has occurred. We know this. The exact mechanism is always up for debate, and always has been, but the actual occurrence of it is accepted universally. So I think the main thing to take out of this is that punctuated equilibria and gradualism are not mutually exclusive. They're not two entirely different ideas. In fact, one is just a refinement of this notion of gradualism. And then again, most people say that phyletic gradualism, in its purest form, that everything was totally slow and steady, was never present in the academic literature to begin with. That there wasn't ever this notion of pure, uniform change over time, ever in the literature. Because that just never was in the evidence, and Darwin himself never even mentioned that it had to be purely uniform like that. But that was a good question, though, and I'd like to move on to the next one, because that one's pretty much just as good. Now, this next question is about the methodology that ID proponents advocate, and they try to kind of use other science and say, well, these scientists are doing the same thing, so intelligent design shouldn't be pointed out as faulty science because these guys are doing the same thing we are, and you accept them as valid science. The author of the question writes, they claim that what they are doing is no different than what SETI is doing. Remember the movie Contact. They are looking for patterns that would indicate something that doesn't occur naturally in nature. Or, for another example, they claim that you can look at seismological data to determine if North Koreans had actually tested a nuclear bomb. They claim that they are looking for a pattern that doesn't occur naturally, i.e. differentiated from an earthquake or whatever, in the data to show that something was caused. Is the SETI project unscientific, or am I getting the wool pulled over my eyes here? They seem to be talking about evidence that can be recognized through science. Is it then wrong to make the leap to use similar methods when looking at cosmology or anatomy or any other discipline? Now, this is a pretty good question, because I can see where people would get confused here between the difference between the SETI project and the intelligent design movement, what the difference between the two is. Now, I would say the claim by the ID proponents that they're doing the same thing as SETI would be an injustice to the SETI project. There's a big difference between what SETI does and what intelligent design group is doing, though it might not seem so clear at first. Now, the SETI project, in its search for extraterrestrial life, is searching for transmissions from the sky that cannot be produced by any other known means. And so far, we haven't found anything, but there are criteria for what these things are. Now, however, the intelligent design advocates have done no such thing. Now, I'm not saying they haven't claimed to find these patterns in nature that cannot be produced naturally, but this is where the difference between SETI and intelligent design movement lies. While the agreement is that SETI is actually doing scientific research, intelligent design movement is not. Now, that may seem arbitrary, but let's look a little more into it. The patterns that the intelligent design movement have found can always be explained by natural mechanisms. They always can. And biologists and others in the field of natural sciences have taken great care to point this out, that everything the intelligent design movement finds can be produced naturally. Also, while in the case of SETI, we're dealing with extraterrestrial life. The ID movement makes the designers specifically vague, and while they don't specifically state what it is, the funding and the history of the intelligent design movement shows that their leanings are towards this designer being a god, which, unlike aliens, cannot be tested, which is his next question, for because of the nature of God, which can change subjectively depending on who you ask. So while SETI has a real means of detection based off of sound science, they're looking for things that cannot actually physically be produced in nature aside from having an artificial source, the intelligent designists make a claim about patterns that can be explained naturally and tend to ignore these explanations and go about and claim, well, you're wrong, so it must be our designer. While SETI is searching for extraterrestrial life, intelligent design movement makes this designer vague. They don't say it's aliens, they don't say it's God, they tend to leave it up to the person who wants to look at it, but again, the history of their movement shows it's more than likely going to be the Christian God, which is the designer. And that, of course, is not science. Now, the next question is about the bacterial flagellum being an example of irreducible complexity. Eric, the questioner, is wondering, after having read Ken Miller's refutation and then the intelligent design movement rebuttals to Miller's argument, what exactly to think about the bacterial flagellum. He writes, I read Behe's book called Darwin's Black Box, and he made the case for the bacterial flagellum and as being an example of irreducible complexity that no one has refuted. Then I read Ken Miller's refutation about the secretion system, which outlined that many of the same things that are in the flagellum are in the secretion system. Then I looked at the rebuttal to Ken's arguments, which basically said that the secretion system is not even a method of cellular motion. And so I'm confused, and it looks to me this is merely a case of ID people saying, it's too complex, so it must be designed, and the other scientists saying, no, it's kind of like that thing over there, so it happens, maybe it happened naturally, but no one really knows for sure. So, what do we really think about this bacterial flagellum? Now, this one's not too difficult to clear up. The problem with these intelligent design rebuttals you've read is that they don't take into account exactly what Ken Miller's refutation utilized, the fact that not every biological process retains the same purpose throughout all of time. The functions of certain mechanisms can change over time, and this is key, and so it is no problem that the secretory system is not part of cellular motion. There are other means of getting around that which predate the flagellum. The main point is that the flagellum need not have been used for motion prior to its full development. It'd be like saying, you know, what is the use of half an eye? Well, obviously not to see, but it probably had some other purpose. And with the case of the flagellum, It had a different purpose prior to such development, and only when this development was complete that it became advantageous to use as a means of transportation. Now, it would appear in the case of the flagellum that the addition of certain proteins allowed it to be used for motion once it was fully developed. And it had a different purpose prior to that, which was, again, the type 3 secretory system, because the parts almost all match up. Now, the two purposes are wholly different, but there's no reason to assume that they were always the same throughout time. There's no reason to assume that the parts that went into the secretory system were the same all the way through time, and the same with the flagellum. There's no reason to assume that the parts did the same thing throughout the whole of time. There are many examples in biology of the evolution of these various parts that change purpose over time, and the flagellum is a great example. So, when thinking about the bacteria flagellum, that's pretty much been debunked by biologists for a while now, and Ken Miller does a great job refuting that. If anyone hasn't seen that, you can find the video of Ken Miller's refutation almost anywhere on the internet, so I'd recommend taking a look at it. And there are also papers published kind of as a direct refutation to Behe over the entire evolution of the bacteria flagellum, a possible layout of what the evolution would be. Now, the last question by this emailer is about my use of the terms creationist and intelligent designer. He writes, "You seem to use the term creationist and intelligent designer interchangeably. It seems that this is a bit disingenuous. I regularly read about creationists bringing God into things, but almost never hear ID people doing that. Is it fair to lump those young earthers who seem particularly unscientific with ID people? I know that some Christian-minded people are funding these things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all the science they have is biased. Would it be fair to me to say that Dawkins is a poor scientist because he is an atheist? I don't see the difference. I know you say that God is not part of science because he isn't testable, but how do you know that unless you actually try? Just saying it doesn't make it so. This point is made more clear if I change out God with aliens. Many people have claimed to have seen aliens. Is everything reported the eyewitness case and all of this history completely false about aliens? Just because I cannot test these claims empirically does not mean that aliens don't exist. It merely means that I cannot test for them very well, SETI being the exception. And if aliens have been to Earth and messed with evolution or human development or made crop circles, then maybe they left behind fingerprints that we can find. The point being that just because you find it difficult to test for something doesn't make it non-naturalistic by definition. Where am I thinking wrong here?" Well, the reason I lump creationists and ID advocates together is because of the history, funding, and religious background of the ID movement. I would suggest a book. I'm trying to think of the name. Oh, yes, it's Intelligent Design's Trojan Horse. It's about the intelligent design movement. It's all about the history of the intelligent design movement, their funding, etc., etc., and it all points to a religious background. Now, of course, the book is a little bit biased, but I would still recommend it for it. It cites about 100 pages worth of sources that everyone can go in and check out, and I've checked out some of them. Of course, I haven't checked out all of them, but I have checked out their sources, and they seem to be valid sources. So I would definitely recommend that book if you want to see where I'm coming from when I make these judgments about the ID movement. Now, creationist is a bit larger of a term than just young Earth creationist. For example, the creationist Hugh Ross is one as well, but he's not a young Earth creationist. In fact, his views differ distinctly from young Earth creationists, and I've listened to him talk, and he seems to advocate that, for example, Kent Hovind, a young Earth creationist, is totally wrong about almost everything that he talks about. And Hugh Ross is a bit more scientific, but then again, he's also a creationist, so I disagree with what he has to say a lot as well. Now, the main reason I lump these two together, besides them being historically based off of religion, is because they're both trying to bring God into the picture. Now, you say they don't explicitly mention God, and then again, check out the background of the intelligent design movement. That's all I can really tell you, is look at where they're coming from, trying to determine the existence of God through his creation, quote-unquote, is about the same thing with what the intelligent design group is doing. They just don't explicitly state it. Therefore, I would include intelligent design advocates as creationists, because they're trying to demonstrate the existence of a God through their creation. And if you don't accept my premise that they're trying to demonstrate the existence of God, well, then we're not really going anywhere. But again, I would check out that book and kind of see where I'm coming from. So I'm just going to base it off of that assumption I made, and if you don't accept it, you know, fine, go check it out. Now, the difference between calling Dawkins a bad scientist because he's an atheist and calling ID advocates creationists is simple. Dawkins obeys the philosophy of science in his research. His being an atheist doesn't mean anything. Ken Miller, for example, is a Christian, But like Dawkins, he obeys the philosophy of science, and so there's no problem. Any religious person can do science as long as they obey the principles. Now you asked, how do I know God can't be tested unless I try? Well, it has to do with the very nature of what God is. Claims made about such a deity are going to be subjective and untestable. Again, I'm just saying it, but one really has to develop an objective means of testing such a being like God, and that can't be done for the reasoning I just stated. All knowledge given to us by God is supposedly through divine revelation. Now, is it possible to reproduce divine revelation? No. If it was, it wouldn't be divine. It'd be a natural thing, and we could investigate it. Now, it's much more reasonable to assume that someone is capable of lying or experiencing some sort of natural event, which we know occurs, rather than taking one person's word for it, that they're talking to some sort of higher power. Now, without any objective means by which to examine God, we can't test such an entity. Now, what the Intelligent Design Movement is doing now is they're claiming, look, we see these patterns, and if we observe patterns, therefore there is this designer. Well, patterns are a subjective thing, and humans recognize these patterns. There's no logical correlation between what humans recognize and what a god would do. In fact, there's this blatant assumption here that God thinks the exact way humans do, and so he would provide patterns that humans would recognize. There's no correlation between that. There's no reason to believe that. And then you said, what if I change out God with aliens? Well, that's not really a fair comparison, because aliens, unlike God, are bound within the universe that we live in, and so are subject to the same laws we are. We know what they can physically be capable of and what they physically cannot be capable of based on what natural law says. No one can violate natural law. That's why everything in the universe can be tested. If everything in the universe could violate natural law, we couldn't test anything because, well, they could do anything they want. And that's the problem with God. There's no restrictions on his power. He's capable of doing anything. And therefore, anything we ever observe can be explained by God, which makes it a null hypothesis. We can't test God when he has no restrictions with which to be tested in. It's impossible. Being hard to test for and impossible to test for are two different things, of course. God, with his ability to violate natural law, makes him impossible to test for because he can do anything then. So, the reason I use creationism and intelligent design interchangeably is because they kind of have the same motives. And again, it's impossible to test for God based on the very nature of God. I cannot try to test for God because first there has to be an objective means by which I could try to test for God. And since none exist and none are possible to exist based on the nature of God, I cannot test God. It is impossible to test God. So what the Intelligent Design Movement is doing is totally unscientific. Now, if they were trying to test for aliens or something that was bound within the universe and they tried to look at patterns in human beings, if there was one that could not possibly be explained, that might be something to look into. But everything that they find is explained by scientists, and scientists have taken great care to explain these things that intelligent design movements claim are so much trouble for evolutionary theory. For instance, you know, various aspects in cosmology or astronomy, all these scientists have found natural explanations for what the ID movement is, and it's simply a matter of who's going to talk louder and who's going to be heard by the public more now. And that seems to be the main problem with the intelligent design movement, is they have a louder voice in public, despite the fact that the academia totally agree that intelligent design movement is not a scientific movement, and what they're trying to do does not fit within the philosophy of science. Again, anybody can be religious and anybody can do science as long as they follow the rules. If they break the rules, then I'm not going to consider them scientists, and I don't think any other scientist would. But again, these questions were really good, and they really get people thinking about how to define what science is, and then look at what science is and compare it to what the intelligent design movement is doing, and then saying, well, look, there's a difference here. They aren't doing the same thing. So again, I thank you for the questions. If you have any more, if I didn't explain them clearly enough, please let me know, and I'd be happy to answer more before a show. Now next, before I end, I'd like to say Catherine sent another piece of follow-up audio based on my response to her earlier, and so I'd like to play that audio right now and kind of give a response to her response to what I had to say about her first question.
Hi, I'm back. I just wanted to clarify what I meant as well as say a couple other things responding to the answer that you gave me concerning my question of relativism as opposed to science and religion. What I want to say that is that The part of philosophy of science you're referring to is the law of parsimony and falsifiability. And no conception of God is consistent with parsimony, and most are not falsifiable. So it's not consistent with science. Religion is not consistent with science at all. Now, science doesn't disprove God, but to say that it's consistent with science is quite wrong, because science has methods by which to determine truth, whereas religion only depends upon faith. And so this is where I'm starting to disagree with you, but I'm kind of uncertain as well, is when you say that science is both, you know, reliable and both part of religion is just very confusing to me. So I just wanted to clarify that that's what I got out of what you said, because you said that religion is completely goes hand in hand with science, and we can see it does not. And so you pointed out the young earth creationism position, and I can agree with you, that completely conflicts with science, but who's to say that even old earth creationism doesn't conflict with science, because they both rely on different methods and different methods by which to determine truth. And I got a lot of my thoughts and opinions from this from a friend who I will not mention, but I just wanted to point out what I wanted to say as a response to your answer. You don't have to put this on the air or even talk about it, but I just wanted to let you know what I got out of what you said. Thank you.
All right. Well, before I had stated that religion and science answer two totally different questions. One answered the why versus science, which is touching on the how things are done. Religion puts a kind of a moralistic twist on it, or maybe why these things are the way they are. Well, it has to do with God, of course, in their answers. So religion and science really deal with two different, totally different things. And when religion tries to answer science questions, well, to be blunt about it, I guess it fails. Science and religion are, again, two totally different things, and religion cannot answer any scientific question. Now, I don't see how religion can be at odds with science, though, if each keeps to its own respective view. Those who believe in a god might argue that such a being is behind every natural process that we see, but science can't do anything about this one way or another. It only deals with the testable. So, kind of to answer what you're saying, is as long as religion doesn't make any claims about testable things, it's not possible for it to conflict with science, because science only deals with what is testable. So that's, I guess, my brief response to what you had to say. Again, I thank you for the audio. It kind of gives me something else to put in the show besides me talking, so I thank you for that. And someone else sent me an audio comment that I'll put on the next podcast in the beginning as kind of a question session. I think I might just add a question session at the beginning of each episode if I get enough, so that'll kind of add something to the show. But as for the next episode, again, I have another question to answer that I just mentioned. But I'm going to try and move away, like I said at the beginning of the show, from just talking about answering questions, and instead I'm probably going to talk about punctuated equilibria. I know I mentioned a lot of it earlier in the podcast with that first question, but there's a lot to talk about with punctuated equilibria. It's a very complex idea. Well, I mean, it is simple in essence, but there are a lot of complex things that go into making it simple, I guess. So I'd like to spend an episode talking about punctuated equilibria, but I probably won't have the time to do the research until after college gets over this year, so probably gonna have to wait another 2 weeks for another episode to come out. I'm just warning you guys ahead of time so I don't leave you, you know, wondering or hoping when the next episode is going to come out. It'll probably be in another 2 weeks. So if you have any questions, I think I'll use this time to plug my email address. It's rlippens, that's LIPPENS, at wavecable.com. So drop me an email. If you have any questions, let me know, comments, concerns, etc. I always love getting them, so you guys keep me going with my podcast. So I'll keep everyone updated on the blog. If you have any questions, post there too if you want. But until I finish my finals, I guess I will talk to you guys next time. Have a great week and enjoy the rest of the school, I guess. I think I'm the last one in school, but I guess enjoy the summer, have fun working. I'll be enjoying doing that in a few weeks. But yeah, have fun, keep safe, and I will talk to you next time.